That video good. That was Lewis and that was Paula. They are so good at what they do. We're moving through the series Exodus, and we understand the story of Exodus is actually our story. It's us learning to walk into a new reality, learning to leave the old behind. And what does it take to leave the old behind? That's what this story of the Exodus and Moses and his people is really all about. And so, as we move through this, the title of today's teaching is A God That Demands Foreskins and the Plight of the Firstborn. I had five people text me, dude, what are you talking about this week? Let's get into it. When Moses, after he experiences the burning bush moment, right? This moment of awareness, he goes to the edge. He goes to the places of mystery where I don't know. The holy ground is uttered. I don't know. He says, I don't know. And in that moment, he has an awareness, a deeper understanding of the mystery of himself, of his story. And so in that moment, we're told he takes a rod. And this rod is kind of, it's like a Harry Potter rod because it turns into a snake. And then all these things, it's weird. It's mysterious. The idea behind the rod is that he's about to go somewhere and he needs his story validated. And so for Egyptian culture as well as Israel culture, every time a new movement started, there had to be some validity to it. And how to validate something was that there was a mystery involved with it. And so Moses is about to go somewhere new. He's about to bring his people into the walk that he's already begun. But there needs to be some sort of validation into the new thing that he's about to walk into. So, Moses, he begins walking in the new life. How many of you have ever been in a job that you just hated? Two of us? Yeah. Your coworkers drove you nuts. There was a bunch of drama. Your boss just absolutely, I mean, the person just didn't get it. Again, you heard over and over again, get me the TPS reports. Do this, do that, and it drove you nuts. And it was a really toxic environment. At some point in time, you will quit or you did quit that job. And you walked into a new work environment. In the new work environment, you realize something. I don't have to look over my back anymore. I can relax a little bit in this new thing. And you had to relearn how to be employed again, how to feel safe. Some of you had a relationship you were in, and it was ugly, it was toxic, it felt like slavery. And then you got out of the relationship. And now you're learning how to be human again. That is the idea for Moses. He leaves the old thing and begins walking in the new, and it's not always easy. So again, Moses is Israel miniaturized. Everything Israel does, Moses does beforehand. This is a literary technique during ancient time periods. Watch this. Moses, he represents Israel. Moses is kept alive because of Egypt. Joseph and his people, in the middle of famine, they go where? Yeah, they go to Egypt. And there in Egypt, they're sustained for a time. It's the same story. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, same story. It's Israel miniaturized. They journey away, though, at some point. If I don't kill that moth. Yes. I feel like, you ever have those moments you feel like it's somebody's watching me? I always feel like somebody. Journey away from Egypt. You move away from Egypt, from slavery. And then you wander in the wilderness, you learn and unlearn certain things. Then you climb the mountain, you have a deeper awareness, and you move into the promised land. Everything Moses does, Israel will do. And so the story, everything that happens with Moses, you will see repeated on a larger scale with Israel. That's the point of the story. So there's this really weird story. I guarantee half of you have never heard it. You're going to say, that's in the Bible? Yeah, it's interesting. Here we go. At a lodging place on the way, the Lord met Moses and was about to kill him. So wait, watch this. So the story goes, God says to Moses, hey, I'm going to use you. I'm going to bless you. I'm going to work with you. You're going to free your people. But on the way there, he tries to murder that person. Does that make sense? This seems a little bit odd, doesn't it? It gets weirder. So Moses is sleeping. He's there at the lodge. And Zipporah, his wife, she kind of picks up on this. God's stalking my husband. He's going to kill my husband. So like any good wife, what she does is she grabs a flint knife, cuts her child's foreskin off, and places it on his knee. Wives, you would do that for your husband, wouldn't you? The first thing you'd think to do. And the bloody foreskin is there on the leg. And this appeases God, I guess. And she says, surely you are a bridegroom of blood to me. And God leaves them alone. That pretty much explains itself. What do you do with stuff like this when you come to the... What do you do with this? We can try to come up with some weird ideas. Well, he needed to be circumcised. That was the idea. He needs to be circumcised. Because, I mean, when you get to Egypt, they're going to ask, right? Hey, Moses, we're so glad you're here to free us. Can we check your son real quick? Need to make sure everything's on the up and up. Not quite. When you understand, though, what's going on historically with these ancient tribal people, it begins to make a little more sense. Understand this. It happens in the middle of the night. And so for this tribe of people, Jacob, Abraham, Esau, Joseph, every big movement starts when you take time in solitude. Every big moment takes time when you stop and you reorganize things about your story. You take time to consider it again. You keep falling prey to certain cycles over and over and over again in your life. And if you don't take time to stop and listen and look over your story, you're going to repeat those things again and again and again. Moses is there in the solitude. And I would argue you and I need to take time away from the noise and just sit in quiet simplicity, consider our stories again. When this happens, we're told Zipporah tries to, she cuts the foreskin, places, there's blood. There's blood of the firstborn. How many of you have ever thought when we're singing songs like, cover me with the blood of Jesus? Have you ever thought about what that image really looks like? How many of your neighbors are still sacrificing goats? How many of you are on a daily basis washing yourselves in literal blood? If we were to do that, they might call us a cult. They do anyways. This would give them more reason. Understand this about the blood. During that time period, the blood, the act of ritual sacrificing, what that meant was that the blood, in the blood is life. And in order to experience life fully, there's sacrifice. There's blood, there's sweat, there's tears, there's struggle. And so, watch this. Moses is Israel miniaturized. When he gets to Egypt, they're going to cover the doorpost with blood. The thing that symbolizes life, the word in the Hebrew, the letter, chi, life. It looks like that, right above the doorpost. And so what this says about Israel is they are a people who will struggle. They will struggle. They will sacrifice. They will be in the blood, the sweat, and the tears. And yet out of the struggle, they will find life. Everyone say, ah. Some of you know this because life is not always easy. Sometimes it's a struggle. I would say oftentimes it's a struggle. And for Israel, in the middle of moving out of Egypt, they had to fully be in the blood, in the sweat, in the tears. That's where the life is found. Now, freedom takes blood, sweat, and tears. How many of you are firstborns? Oh, man. Or keep your hands up. Just look around you. All those same people, those are the same people that were angry when little brother or sister were born. You can put them down now. You're the ones that deserve all the blessings. Right? You're the ones at family gatherings when little sister or little brother show up and they start talking about the great thing they're doing, you're the one going, yeah, it's fine, but you know what I did? You know you. You know you're that. You know exactly how you act. You're the second parent in the family, aren't you? Yeah, you are. You're the one who has all the great advice, but you're not really living it. And everyone in the family knows. You're the firstborn. You're the eldest. Israel saw themselves as the eldest son. When you read the writings and the arguments in Midrash, what you'll see is Israel believed that their God sent Torah to the world, but they were the only ones who chose to accept it. And so now their role is to give out the advice to the rest of the world. How you choose to give it out, well, that's interesting, isn't it? Think about the prodigal son for a moment. Most of us, we try to say, well, you know, the eldest son, that's the Pharisees. Those are the bad Jews, and the good ones are here. No. Israel saw themselves as the eldest brother. So what Jesus is saying is actually really controversial. He's saying this. You, Israel, you eldest son, who think you deserve it all, who get jealous and frustrated and feel a little insecure, you are equally as blessed as Rome, as Greece, as Egypt. God, the blessings of the world are all there equally for both of you, no matter what you do or don't do. It's all there. The idea of the prodigal son says this: I'm always with you. Everything, all blessings out there are yours. You guys get it? The eldest son struggles with this, though. For the eldest son, we don't always like to hear this because we think we deserve, because we've done all the good work. Eldest sons. Danielle and I, we have two kids, Ashlyn and Kaysen, and they're wonderful. When we had Kaysen, though, we began to realize that there could potentially be some jealousy. Ashlyn could turn out like me. Lord, help me. And so we thought, we got to figure out this parenting thing. We got to read some books. We got to do a little bit of discussion. We got to figure this out. And so we found a lot of interesting advice for parents trying to help the firstborn. And what we found is, even though the firstborn can kind of be a brat, the firstborn can kind of expect everything and get frustrated when others get something, the firstborn actually could potentially help foster and nurture and be a loving presence for that new life. So here's some of the advice I got that I think is so beautiful and relevant to church community. Number one is this: first, show that firstborn unconditional love. You will never be able to show other people unconditional love and acceptance if you yourself don't experience that. We have a lot of people who pretend to love people and accept them who have never actually felt accepted and unconditionally loved themselves. And that's why I struggle with this idea of original sin. This idea that you're bad, you're inherently bad, you'll always do the wrong thing. It's a very low view of mankind as well as God. You are originally blessed. You are a walking, living miracle. And because of that, you understand all blessings, all beautiful things are right there. You don't have to fight your nature. You live in it. And so when you are unconditionally loved and you understand that, you can share that with others. There are no conditions to it. You just do it. Another thing, there is enough love and blessing for everyone. How many of you firstborns, you always said the word mine? And at 30 years old, you still say it. Well, it's mine. I deserve that. Some of us were getting to the place where mom and dad are beginning to give us certain monies that they said they'd give when they die, but they want to love and they lovingly give us certain things, right? And we'll argue with our brothers and sisters. Well, that I deserve that. I get that. And we'll have these ugly arguments over territory and blessing. Whereas a good parent says to their children, we have enough love and enough blessing for both of you. So much so that it overflows. That's healing. That's restorative. Another thing we learned to show them pictures and videos of their past. How many of you have ever used that on your iPhones? You go to the albums and you hit the little play button, it adds music to it, and you just watch it. It's fantastic. They make a little slideshow there for you. We'll watch that together. And it's so much fun to do as a family. And what it reminds my daughter and my son is that they're loved and they have a journey. And they begin to understand certain cycles they've been in and other things they repeat. And we're able to begin moving toward wholeness together. They understand they have a story. Another thing I've taught my daughter is to be in love unconditionally anyways. Then I had an experience. And it's funny because I'm going to share this one. A new friend of mine, we met for coffee. And I'm sitting there. And he says, tell me your story. And you don't have too many people ask you that very often, do you? Share with me your story. I said, okay. And I shared my story. And I have to say, this is one of the first times in years now that I've shared something and people haven't been looking down at their phones. He's fully engaged. I shared my story. And when I shared my story, what was interesting is we both stood up and he said this, I'm walking with you, brother. When you are going through something and someone says to you, I am walking with you. That does something to you. What if the elder brother, rather than throwing vitriolic words at someone, rather than judging, rather than doing the negative, what if the older brother was found there in the struggle, walking with you? See, we have a lot of trolls in our culture today. But we don't have a lot of loving elder brothers and sisters. The world could use more of you. More of you who are willing to walk with each other. Walk with each other in the messy, bloody journey of life. And when you walk with one another, the idea in the Hebrew is that you have just experienced life. And so right now, as the deacons come forward, we're going to participate in a very ancient tradition called communion. And yeah, it wasn't communion back then. It was actually called Passover. But here's what we're going to think about today. When you get the bread and you get the wine, I want you to consider your journey. If you want to just start passing that out, that would be fantastic. When you get the juice and you get the bread today, I want you to consider your journeys, your bloody, sweaty, painful, glorious journeys. I want you to consider the people who have walked those journeys with you, those moments. Because the beauty of communion is that what it does is it brings people together. Communion brings people together over the shared experience of Christ. So as the deacons begin to walk by and give you those elements, please grab them. Anyone that can't get up and get to the bread and the wine, just raise your hand. We'll have someone bring it to you. But pick up those two pieces, the bread and the wine. And again, take a moment. The Christ path was the bloody, the sweaty journey. But it was the journey that brings life more abundantly. It's learning to serve one another, to love your enemies unconditionally, to celebrate the older brother and the younger brother. It's a celebration of life together. And it starts by examining our lives and our bloody, crazy, chaotic journeys. And please understand, please, everyone participate in this. You are not good enough for communion and you're not bad enough for communion. Wherever that idea came from, leave that out. Everyone participates in this. This is community. We've all been part of this journey together. I want you to close your eyes. I want you to think of the people, your traveling companions that you've had through the hard times this year. Think of those people who have walked with you. Aren't you grateful for them? Think of the God that is love, that has sustained you through it. That loving presence of the community and the people all around you. Be grateful for this. Also, take a moment as your eyes are closed. Consider the painful, bloody moments you've had this year. You have survived. And if you're still in the middle of it, communion teaches us there is resurrection. There is new life to be had just around the corner. Hold on. And so now we will begin to participate in this together. As the deacons come up and they grab their own. We'll let you guys do it later. We got to have that beautiful music, Betty. If you did not get communion, please let us know again. All right, we're good. And so, with this Brett wine, we'll do the wine. With this wine, may we remember the Christ path, the bloody path, the one that led to forgiving enemies, restoring relationship, restoring a nation. May we remember that kind of love, and may we begin to walk in it as well. Drink this in remembrance of me. And the bread, the body that was broken. We understand through the story of Christ, when he walks this road, he is beaten, bloodied, broken. And you and I and Israel was called to walk that path. And it's not always easy to love and forgive. It's not always easy to love unconditionally. But that's where the life is. And so today, may you, in remembrance of Christ, eat this bread as well. There will be opportunities in the back. Those seats should be open for anyone willing or wanting to do foot washing while the band plays the last couple songs. And so if you'd like to wash the people's feet next to you, if you are in a relationship and there has been struggle, you haven't always been able to see eye to eye, maybe this is your moment to take them over and humbly serve them, wash their feet. Say, brother, sister, I will walk with you. So if that's you today, while the band plays, feel free to get up and walk over to those corner seats and take part in the foot washing as well. And if you don't, feel free to sing along with the band for these last couple songs.